It's the Wired Dakota UK podcast, episode 114 for Friday, the 8th of March, 2013. This week, we're going to learn how Samsung wants to enlist the help of your eyeballs to enhance the functionality of its next Galaxy smartphone. We're going to find out about some massive and very cold camels, and we'll spread a few truths about the incredible story of a baby allegedly cured of HIV. All that, plus some exciting new segments coming up as we mount our news camel for a jaunt around this week's pyramid of Wired News. Ahoy, ahoy, I'm Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. I'm currently eating a piece of cheese. And joining me is Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And this week, David Cornish.
Hello.
No underscore there.
None.
I'm actually not going to be here next week, so I've got to go off to something in New York, something exciting.
Oh, yeah? What's
about
that?
A Galaxy. I'm going to be over in New York to cover the launch of the Galaxy S4, which is the new Samsung smartphone that's going to be announced on the 14th. So we'll be there to have a bit of a hands-on, bit of a full report. And fittingly, actually, we're going to start this week with a story about the Galaxy S4, because there has been a rumor that the new smartphone will offer the ability to scroll the content on the device's screen by tracking your eye movements using a front-facing camera. And there's a report out this week that noted that this rumor corresponds quite accurately with a trademark filing submitted by Samsung in January called, quote, iScroll and, quote, iPause, as well as the Samsung iScroll in the US, which was registered in February. Now, Samsung has used eye tracking technology in previous phones. The S3 actually can detect your eyes to know when to lock the screen. So when you're not looking at it, it can lock the screen and so on and so forth. So it all ties into some existing technology. I think this sounds quite interesting.
But I dart my eyes around so much. Like, I'll flitter my eyes from the screen to kind of pop up, look at the TV or whatever. Like, and there might be kind of unintentional eye movements that end up scrolling you around some web page that you don't want to do.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to sort of go accidentally cross-eyed and like zoom into a page.
I'm interested to know how much more, how easier this will be rather than just me using my finger. At the moment, I'm quite... We've just learnt about touch screens. Like, we're all just about getting used to devices which we can touch and manipulate, and we're learning lots of new cursor symbols for our hands, and now they might change the game again.
I think it's these sort of technologies tend to be supplementary.
Yeah.
They tend to complement existing navigation, so it's probably just something you would get used to, you know, reading a long article, and it just becomes a bit more fluid naturally without you having to interact with it, but you'd still do the majority of your scrolling and swiping and things with your fingers.
I can imagine being dead useful for auto cue.
Yes,
and for relieving any RSI that you might be experiencing from
excessive finger use.
Yeah.
This is all going to come out next week when I'm over in the US to get hands and possibly eyes on with the new Samsung Galaxy phone.
Imagine if you actually had to scroll it with your eyeball.
No, that'd be
that would be terrible.
Like, you could do it better if you were a pug.
Yeah.
whose eyes sort of protrude.
They're
quite
already out there
a bit. So do check back next week. Obviously, we'll have full reports on the website on wired.co.uk next week when the announcement is made. David, I'm going to turn to you. This week, there was an amazing, absolutely fantastic story about a baby allegedly, quote unquote, cured of HIV shortly after being born. And it was probably on every newspaper and on every scientific website and blog and Twitter stream imaginable. We looked into the background of this and we found out some interesting things we wanted to bring out of this story.
We did.
Where should we start?
We'll start with the story itself. On the 3rd of March, news spread rapidly of a functional HIV cure after a baby born in rural Mississippi was, as you say, quote, cured of HIV. Basically, the mother was unaware that she'd contracted the virus, and by the time a routine test came back to inform the medical team, it was too late into labour to administer the precautionary drugs. Pediatric HIV specialist Hannah Gray gave the infant an unusually potent dose of 3 antiretroviral drugs within 30 hours of birth, something that doesn't always happen. 2.5 years later, the child has been is being decreed functionally cured of HIV and is now living a drug-free life.
What exactly does functionally cured mean? Does this mean that it's still in the system but it's not doing anything?
Yes, in very small amounts, HIV is present in the bloodstream, but it hasn't infected the white blood cells of the child and it's not replicating itself. So it's not sterilised cured, it is functionally cured.
So this story so far is not dissimilar to the man who's become known as the Berlin patient, who was the first person known ever to have been, again, cured of HIV. And that resulted from a bone marrow transplant. And the donor of the bone marrow, it was believed, had some sort of a genetic immunity to HIV. And somehow between the transplant and the implant, I suppose, the I'm not sure what the term is, though. If it...
Infection?
No.
When you implant bone marrow.
Transplant.
It caused something to change in his body that actually saw the HIV levels drop and eventually disappear. But this, as far as I'm aware, and I learned a lot of this from our feature this week, which Liat wrote, this doesn't mean that we are sitting on a potential cure for HIV and AIDS, right?
No. Basically, because this cure is at both once accidental and also quite possibly not repeatable, it's something that we might be able to learn some very significant things from, but it isn't an instant cure which can be replicated for all those currently infected with HIV. So one thing that's not quite clear is, as you say, the case with the Berlin patient, it could be that this child is itself an elite controller. So like the person that the bone marrow is taken from, this child's immune system could basically have an effective suppression of the HIV virus, which could be natural to this child. That's not yet clear yet.
But usually what they do, if a mother has HIV and she becomes pregnant, normally they give the antiretroviral drugs while she's pregnant, and that then prevents the virus from being passed on,
yeah,
right?
And I think most of the passing on actually occurs during childbirth.
It does.
They're not actually infected typically from just it being, while they're gestating, developing.
Yeah. And transition prevention is already very successful within the UK. So yeah, it requires the mother to be diagnosed during pregnancy. And if she takes the treatment in the later stages of pregnancy and then doesn't breastfeed her child, then the chances of her child being HIV positive are under 1%. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible step forward in HIV prevention, which has already happened. So it's this technique, which has basically giving the child these antiretrovirals very early on after birth, it's not going to be something that's going to be seen to be replicated in all cases now. Basically, there have already been... We spoke to a number of different consultants on this, and they gave us cases in which children had received antiretroviral drugs very early on in their life, and they hadn't been cured in the same way that this child has. So it's not just about getting antiretroviral drugs into a child very early on. Mm.
So the bottom line here is that the case isn't the calling card of a potential cure. It's an extremely useful case to hopefully advance research.
Certainly. We can hopefully learn from this child's immune system response to know what was going on in this child's system, immune system, so that we might be able to replicate that pattern in future patients. But it won't be something that, as we say, it can't be the case that all children now will potentially have antiretroviral drugs put into them within 30 hours of birth.
Mm. Well, I'm guessing the takeaway point, prevention's still better than hoping for a cure. And if you want to read into this story, we've got a huge report with lots of input from doctors and scientists and charities. Search for HIV baby on wired.co.uk. You will find our story. Liv, also in the news, a 50,000-ton mountain cave-dwelling magnet that could be built in the next 3 years.
I'm attracted to this story.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Hey. Oh, dear.
Sorry.
This is the Baba Atomic Research Group in India, and it's planning to install this massive magnet in a cave in the Tamil Mountains.
Why?
Why? That's very good point.
They're going to go through an awful lot of trouble to do it.
Yeah. No, it's for research purposes. It's going to be part of a particle physics neutrino observatory. And what they're really looking for is neutrinos, which are believed to be part of the elusive dark matter, the hypothesized material that's meant to account for a large part of the universe.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about this quite a bit in the past, actually. I mean, there's some amazing experiments that dark matter researchers create, you know, going into the very depths of Earth's bowels to install detecting equipment, because it's just, you have to get rid of all possible contamination.
Yeah, so this one's going to be at 1,300 metres underground, and it will steal the title of the world's largest magnet from CERN. CERN has a magnet called the Compact Muon Solenoid, which weighs a measly 12,500 tonnes. That's 12,500 tonnes.
This is about four times heavier.
This is about four times heavier, wow. Yes, exactly.
It's not often we have magnet news on the show, is it?
No. But this should be being built. It's kind of waiting for final kind of sign-off, because there's some issues about conservation in that area. It was proposed to be in one location, but due to the elephant migration routes and tigers, it's actually been shifted to an alternative place. But it could be built by 2018, I think it is.
Oh, 2018, I see. So we have two possible dates. It could be 2016, it could be 2018.
I think it's more likely to be 2018.
Should we settle on 2017?
Yeah.
Just to be safe.
I'm fascinated to know whether this might throw off any local animals' habitating patterns. Like, I know that some birds and some insects, they navigate with the Earth's magnetic polars, and I'd love to know if now
quite possibly
ants, or
it'd be interesting. I wonder if they've done any studies near the CERN's CERN's magnet, but I don't know.
Yes, well, if you know, podcast@wired.co.uk, David would be fascinated to find out, and I will look forward to him telling me the answer in a concise way. David, I'm going to come back to you though. So Arctic camels.
Yes.
Now, this was an incredibly popular story this week. I think probably our most popular story on the site this week was this one, if not possibly the Tomb Raider review, which we'll get to later, don't worry.
Yes.
Let me ask you, why were we talking about camels this week?
This was a story about the remains of an extinct species of giant camel being discovered in the Ellesmere Island area, the Arctic region of Canada. Yeah, some researchers found some remains of what they now believe is a previously unknown species of giant camel, which they have deemed the High Arctic Camel. So a completely new species we've never known about before.
And these were almost 30% larger than the Kamai that we have today.
Basically they discovered some fragments of bone from the tibia of this camel, and using a visualization which reconstructs this bone, they believe that the tibia, so the leg bone, is roughly 29% larger than those of modern day camel species. Though it's then very hard to know exactly how large this camel would be, because we've just got its leg.
It could be like long and thin, or it could be a little chubster.
Could have had a shorter neck, could have had a longer neck. It's very hard to approximate just exactly how big, but 29% in terms of its tibia. It makes the Hyatt camel a similar size to another camel, giant camel genus known as, called the Paracamelius gigas, which I think he's a super sounding guy. The creature was identified thanks to the analysis of 30 fossilized fragments of tibia bone, each thought to be around 3.5 million years old, which places the High Arctic camel, firmly in the mid-Pliocene period, which is a period in the geological timescale. Researchers published their findings in Nature Communications, explaining the camels originated in North America and dispersed to Eurasia via the Bering Isthmus, a land bridge linking Alaska and Russia. Their research results suggest that the evolutionary history of the modern camels can then be traced back to the lineage of these giant camels that was well established in a forested Arctic region.
Now, this is all fascinating, but part of this report include mention of a three-toed horse.
It did. Yes, the High Arctic camel, the area around Canada where these remains were found. Other remains were found in a similar time period, which included neighbours such as badgers, deerlets, beavers, and a species of three-toed horse.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Sorry, what's a deerlet? Is that just a small deer?
I think it's just a small deer.
Okay.
Think pygmy deer.
Imagine how difficult it would be to make a horse hoof. A horseshoe if it had three toes.
Challenging.
Think about that for a moment.
If it had toes, it probably wouldn't need to have the shoes.
Yes, that's true. Well, we've got a full report on the website, and you can be one of the goodness knows how many countless billions of people read it this week. If you want to read it, search for, well, Giant Camel on wired.co.uk. You will find it. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to leave the medical world behind as we go and ask the question, what's up with space?
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. Now we're going to, we've decided, Liv and I were talking the other day and we thought, wouldn't it be quite nice if we had introduced sort of segments into the wired.co.uk podcast? You know, we've been doing this for sort of 2 years or so. We quite often have news story after news story, feature, maybe another news story. We thought it'd be quite interesting to experiment with sort of branding some of our news stories.
Yeah.
That was the result of the conversation.
And here we go. Yeah. We're about to do it right now.
So we're going to start introducing these. And the first category we're going to come up with is, what's up with space? So this week, what's up with space is that, well, I'll just read the headline. Poop-lined walls to shield Mars-bound astronauts.
Wow.
Yes.
Liv, fascinating bit of science here.
Well, this is yet another manned mission to Mars, which has been planned for 2018. And what they want to do is use human waste as a shield to protect the passengers from cosmic radiation. The Inspiration Mars mission is going to take advantage of a particular planetary alignment, so it uses a kind of slingshot effect to allow a two-person crew to make a round trip in just 501 days, which is quicker than it would normally take. But this capsule would obviously need to have enough food for that time period, so it's almost 2 years. And at the same time, it needs to also store the food at the other end, i.e. when it gets pooed out. And then also, another requirement of this journey is to protect the two passengers from cosmic radiation.
So this is two birds with one brown stone.
So they've come up with this really interesting system, actually. It's called the water walls system. And what this is a kind of a lining of the aircraft of kind of plastic bags, which would slowly fill up with the poo. And it would do a kind of separation of the poo and the liquid via osmosis. And that water would be a 40 centimeter thick radiation shield.
Wow.
And then this would obviously be supported by the kind of dried out food and feces.
Now, this is for a mission that is hoping to be launched in 2018.
Yes.
January. And they are looking for a man and a woman to do the journey. Yeah. And I believe they're after a married couple, actually.
They have said that. And it's kind of a question, I guess, if you're spending that long in that close confines, you kind of need to have quite a strong bond with that person. It could be massively awkward if you put two strangers in together, I'd imagine.
It could also be massively awkward if they got sick of each other. I mean, I spent 2 weeks on a narrowboat with a guy that I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
By the end of the 2 weeks, I wanted to put him into the engine.
Well, I think that's why they're going for married couples, ideally ones that have been married for a long time, so know that that's probably not going to happen.
But even that, I mean, can we find any married couples who've never been separated for 500? I mean, that's a long time
that you can't just... And it's a small
space. Yeah, you can't just pop out and walk the dog to get some headspace.
No.
No. Well, we'll keep our eye very much on that. Next up in our segment, we're going to move into our test lab. So we do a lot of reviews on wired.co.uk, mostly technology, occasionally games. That's the topic of this one, because David and I are both very big fans of Tomb Raider. Ooh. And there is a new Tomb Raider game that was released this week. It's almost 20 years since the original Tomb Raider landed on the PlayStation. I think it might have been on PC as well, actually.
Yeah, I think it was the Sega
Saturn.
Yeah, it was the Sega Saturn.
Sega Saturn.
Old school.
And I reviewed this game for the website this week, and I have to say, I absolutely loved it. It is a reboot, effectively, of the franchise. So it's not like sort of Tomb Raider 13. It's just called Tomb Raider. It features a young Lara Croft, and the game itself tells kind of the origin story, if you like, of Lara Croft. In the game series so far, she's been this sort of hardened, wealthy, very well-researched, kind of well-clad in explorer's outfit type person who's sort of known her peanuts. I don't know, what do you say, knows her cheese. Archaeology wise,
yes,
yeah, you know what I'm getting at.
She would know a giant camel when she saw one.
Yeah, she's
exactly.
A well-informed badass.
And this game basically tries to explain how that came to be. So you're abandoned on this island. There's this ritualistic activity going on. You can't escape. It's actually not 100% different from Lost as a plot line, but it really is amazing. The game's been in the work for a number of years, and it's quite a departure from the original Tomb Raider games, which were very, you know, you've had this great sense of isolation. There was just you were walking through or running through caves, exploring little holes in the tops of caves. You would like fight bears, you would fight the occasional human, but mostly it was bears and bats and you know, hyena dogs and things like that. You were solving puzzles, you were finding a key to open a room at another part of this massive tomb, collecting medipacks and stuff like that. And this game has kind of left the vast majority of that behind, and it has sort of brought the series into what I would say a more typical action game for modern console gaming, which are things like, you know, there's a lot more interaction, there's a much more pronounced storyline with dialogues, lots of cutscenes, and lots of cutscenes where you have to do the sort of, you know, press X to not die sort of thing. So it's very cinematic and choreographed, a lot of which wasn't really present in the older games. But also things like auto-generating health, a hell of a lot more violence, and significant attention paid to graphics and the kind of technology that's being used to make the games look as realistic as possible. But the overall result is a game that I think takes a large part of what made Tomb Raider good in the earlier days, a kind of big open landscapes exploration, and blends it with a, you know, not the world's deepest story, but an enjoyable one, but also takes a lot of elements that the kids who maybe have never played Tomb Raider before, they're just used to things like Uncharted and Call of Duty. There's enough for them as well. There's a lot of violence and a lot of just running around and shooting stuff, and you can sort of get whatever side of that you want out of the game. And I was really impressed.
Do you think will it annoy older Tomb Raider fans, like fans of the classics? Oh, it will annoy.
It'll annoy some of the diehard, you know, Tomb Raider 1 and 2 were the best games ever made sort of fans. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about the game, I think, though, is that it will keep most of the fans interested. I was a big fan of the game series, and I really enjoyed it. But it will also get a lot of new fans into the franchise and perhaps explore some of the older games. So I think I give it a 9 out of 10 in my score.
Super.
I think it's well worth playing. And I'm not sure what else to say about that, apart from
go and get it. By the sounds of it.
Yes, we like it. Go and read my review if you want. Search for Tomb Raider review on wire.co.uk. Some of the comments are a bit hit and miss, depending on whether it's a fan or not a fan writing it. But I'll.
Isn't that the internet?
A lot of them, I think, have got keyboards big enough so they can type with their fists. Put it that way. Now, for our final section of segment of our podcast this week. Meanwhile, in Japan. So this is a section that I hope will recur from time to time. Anyone who knows me knows that I have something of an obsession with Japan and Japanese culture and things. And there was something I saw this week that I just had to write about. It is game-related. Liv, tell me the title of the game that this story is the subject of.
That was a convoluted sentence.
It was,
but
sorry.
It is Conception, Please Give Birth to My Child.
Yes, it's a Japanese role-playing game that was released last year, and I was very pleased to hear that it's getting a sequel.
Oh my!
Yes,
what did
we've
you?
We've all been waiting for it.
I can't. Yeah. What did the original game do, and what's this one gonna do?
Okay, so the original game, which was released on the Sony PSP, was kind of a dungeon-based RPG adventure game that saw you take on the role of a male student called Isuki, and your purpose was to conceive a child with as many as a dozen quote star maidens, and the offspring would aid you in a fight to save the world from a kind of miasma that was plaguing existence.
Wow.
Now, the thing is, the reason why we're not picking this out just to say, hey, there's a quirky game. There are billions of those all around the world. But this game, when reviewed by Famitsu, which is a really highly respected Japanese gaming magazine, when they reviewed it, they gave it rave scores. It did really, really well. It clearly performed well commercially. They're making another one. And I just find it absolutely fascinating, this sort of the different levels of experimentation that go into game making. When you look at, I mean, this has come from a very well-known, quite large games publisher. They publish things like Call of Duty and even Tomb Raider and Bioshock and things like that in the Japanese market. They're not some little tiny indie developer.
Yeah,
they've got, you know, a decent reputation, and this is sort of a type of game that they're happy to experiment with, make a sequel to, and Whereas I kind of think that over here, our developers are just nowhere near this adventurous or creative when it comes to odd games. It's like, let's do another reboot. Let's do
It's that chicken and egg scenario of the money is in those kind of standard games at the moment. Like, you don't want to move too far away from first-person shooters or big adventurers. Like, people are putting a lot of money into big blockbusters. And you never know if you spend a lot of time building something as quirky and wonderful as this, whether all of those gamers are going to depart with their hard monies to buy it. So you really want a game like this to do amazingly in the Western market, so that we can see more developers take that risk and make something really quirky.
Liv, would you want to play a game with this sort of storyline?
Well, what I like is the please. It's not conception, give birth to my child. It's please give birth to my child.
Well, so that is a rough Japanese translation. There are other ones that are things like please have my baby.
Okay.
But the please actually stays
there.
You
know, it's polite. Maybe, yeah, I'd be interested to see. I don't really want to go around, you know, spraying...
finish that sentence carefully.
Spraying bodily fluids around haphazardly, just on the off chance that I impregnate women in the game.
A star maiden.
I'm just a bit worried about how graphic the actual the gameplay is.
I would be quite interested to see if this game would ever get a European release. The previous one did not, but it's got a decent amount of attention in the West. And there are some very odd games that have been released over here that have actually done quite well. You know, sexy games.
What was that dog one that was also for when you went? We're in Tokyo, you saw...
That was
dogs.
Tokyo Jungle.
Yes.
Yeah, which was a game where you play as one of many different mammals, and Tokyo has been evacuated by all human life after an apocalypse. And the aim of the game, and the game's great fun, is to basically build up an army of mammals by breeding with each other and getting the kind of symbiotic aid from other mammals, so that, you know, a dog may be small enough to fit through a hole to get some meat for a bear, but the bear in return will be able to, you know, fend off attacks from other large mammals and things like that. And it's very weird, and there are scenes in it where you sort of have to walk up to a lady dog and press X and they mount, and then the screen fades to black, but voila, baby dogs.
You know what, I'm detecting a theme now. Last week we discussed Mugenics, which is the cat lady sim where you get to breed loads of cats. Maybe this is a new thing. It's like, yeah, you're in charge of a population and you've got to create the most powerful ubermensch, that's dangerous territory, that you can create.
The Wired.co.uk podcast, bringing you trends in animal reproduction and video
eugenics.
Games.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to wrap up on that note, but if you've heard anything you want to give us feedback on, podcast@wired.co.uk is the place to do it. David's going to tell us other ways.
Yes, you can follow us on Twitter. We are @WiredUK. We've also got a Facebook page, so head to Facebook and give us a like and see what we're up to there. And you can also email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
And I won't be around next week because I'll be in America again, reporting from the scene of the S4 launch.
Reading screens
getting
with your
my,
eyes.
Getting my balls of eye all over Samsung's new S4. But Liv will be in here.
I will.
And
steering the ship.
She will be sailing you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Lips.
What?
Can't smile without lips.
Or teeth?
You can't.
Or facial muscles.
It would look really weird.
It would.
Really, very bizarre.
Can birds
can birds smile?
No.
No.
It's like if
some of them.
Well, they smile the other way up, don't they? They smile like that because their lips are basically their beak. So it's like, instead of grinning horizontally, they kind of...
So they smile that way around. I see what you mean.
Now. I mean?
So they're sad. No, they're not. Yeah, I see.
No.
Yeah. They open their mouth.
They open their mouth
in order to express joy.
Yeah.
This isn't helping at
no,
all.
No, stop.
Okay.
Okay.